Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Today, we talk about healthy eating and ultra-processed foods with our guest, Beth Olson, back with us, associate professor and extension specialist in the Nutritional Science Department at UW-Madison. Great to have her back. And as we talk with Beth, I hope you'll join in. What do you want to know about ultra-processed foods and maybe their nutritional value? Any tips for identifying ultra-processed foods at the grocery store? Do you use them? The number's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Beth Olson, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Always fun to be here.
So, how would you define ultra-processed foods?
Well, that's one of our tricky problems, Larry. There's no label for it, so a consumer can't, you know, go in and pick up a food and say, "Oh, this is an ultra-processed food." And one of the differences, if they're trying to pick foods based on dietary advice that we often give with ultra-processed foods, is it isn't actually about what we would usually talk about, nutrients, foods, how those foods work together in a diet. It's about how much that food is processed. So how much it's processed, how it's processed, how many processed ingredients. So I would say if you're concerned about your nutrition, we always, the use of ultra-processed food isn't very different from where we were before in terms of, you know, we're trying to encourage people to pick up more whole foods and fewer packaged foods.
Yeah. So my loaf of bread that I bought a couple days ago is not ultra-processed, I wouldn't think.
Well, it depends.
Oh,
so
boy.
That's what's really tricky about it is it's the ingredients. So if we just think about maybe making a food at home versus making one at the or buying one from the store, you might make a food at home and you use flour and sugar and water and, you know, if it's a bread, yeast or something else.
Mm-hmm.
If you're buying it at the store, they might be adding in, you know, an agent to stop mold or some other thing which would be considered a processed ingredient and make it an ultra-processed food. So I think for some foods, you know, the definition is pretty similar to what we've been saying. But for some foods, you're kind of in the middle of, it still might be quite a healthy food, a whole grain bread, whole grain cereal. And just because you make it at home doesn't mean that it's not healthy.
So what's the problem with ultra-processed?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out. A lot of scientists are working on that. And there's kind of two trains of thought. One is some of those ingredients aren't ones we would typically have in our house. You know, historically, we wouldn't have consumed. So, you know, for decades, centuries, we've been eating sugar. But an ingredient like high fructose corn syrup as a sweetener, we haven't been using as long. So there's some concern that kind of all of those ingredients that are processed to add to manufacture foods for various reasons, maybe all those together are a problem. But the other one is, are we eating lots of those foods and we're pushing out some foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains that are good for us? So
okay.
Is it the foods or is it the absence of other foods?
So I'm trying to figure out how best to put this. So my loaf of bread, if it contained something that's going to make it good on the shelf for 2 weeks.
Yeah, it might be okay. You know, sometimes I think some of these ingredients, in my opinion, are relatively benign. So a common preservative is citric acid. Since it has an acidic quality, it inhibits the growth of some microorganisms. That's the same acid that's in citrus fruits. So I don't know that adding that as a trade-off for being able to buy that bread and have it for a while without it, you know, going moldy or whatever, you know, that might be worth it.
Robert in Wausau has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I just thought I might share my little tidbit. During the 2 years of the pandemic, I lost 90 pounds because I started looking at the ingredients in the nutrition on the packaging of the food I buy in the grocery store. And I created this list of rules to follow. If the food I buy has more than 5 ingredients and any of the ingredients is pronounced in a way that I can't, is spelled in a way I can't pronounce, I don't buy it. I also don't buy anything with birch sugar or xylitol, anything hydrogenated, and anything with high fructose corn syrup, which they're cramming in everything. Because of this, I lost weight. I wake up more clearly. I'm sleeping better at night, and I highly advise anyone else to follow those simple rules.
Well, Robert, thank you for calling. Comment on Robert's idea with the 5 ingredients.
Yeah, it's fabulous that he found a way to eat healthy, and I'm assuming he needed to lose that weight and did, and he feels good. That's just wonderful. One can do that. I mean, certainly when you look at a product, if it has a very long, extensive ingredient list, it's probably a little further away from a whole food than closer to it. The one area you do want to be, I think, you know, be cautious is if ingredients sound foreign, but maybe they're not that bad. Citric acid's an example. Some of the vitamins that we fortify with or minerals have pretty long scientific sounding names, but it's just maybe vitamin B12 or vitamin C, ascorbic acid. So that's where I think you want to be careful. And you know, you're going to see that a lot in our fortified foods, grains, fruit, cereals, anything that is it's fortified. The other thing I would say is, I got to put my plug in here as someone who used to do research with dietary fiber and health. Take a look also at the nutrition facts panel, not just the ingredients list, and see, you know, does it contain fiber? Is it a whole grain and it contains fiber? Then maybe it's worth having some other ingredients added.
Ron in Wolf River will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Hello. I have a question about xanthan gum and guar gum. I notice that on every loaf of bread, every tortilla shell, even in something like Melinda's hot sauces, xanthan gum is in there. What is it, and why do we need it in all these foods?
Oh, boy. I think, not positive on all of those products, but a lot of those ingredients, the gums, there are also things like cellulose, are actually types of dietary fiber. Now, these aren't, you know, somebody didn't throw in a vegetable or a fruit. They're isolated from products, and they're used sometimes for things like thickening. Hmm. So it's really the sensory properties of the food that they're used. Again, you know, everybody can take a look at those ingredients, decide for themselves. For me, I'm a little less worried about the fiber additions because we don't eat enough fiber. And, you know, I'm less worried about those because generally they're natural ingredients, but they are isolated. I don't want to pretend they're, you know, dietary fiber out of nature put in. They're isolated from other products and put in for some sensory property like thickening. You'll see thickeners a lot in things like lower calorie salad dressing so that they're not watery. They put in a fiber that kind of thickens them up. Yep,
there we go. Thanks, Ron, for calling. You can join in too. Number to call 800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. So lunch today is, for me, is a yogurt, an apple, and 2 nectarines, I think.
Wonderful. Well, there's probably no ultra-processed foods in those. Lots of whole foods, lots of nutrients, lots of protein, lots of fiber. You know, I'm big on that.
So I'm safe at least for lunch today.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
And we'll see how you get when you get to dinner.
Yeah. Well, dinner. I'll be on the road today. We'll be broadcasting from La Crosse tomorrow.
Ah.
So I'm probably going to be dining in a restaurant somewhere in La Crosse.
Yeah, and that can be a place where it's trickier for people. If they're eating out a lot, you know, eating fast food at lunch, picking up something through the drive-thru for breakfast, picking up something to take home, you might have what people would consider ultra-processed foods or foods that are, you know, a little higher in fat, a little less fiber.
So what are the scientists researching about the ultra-processed foods?
Well, what they're doing is they're looking at people's diets over time. They're classifying how many ultra-processed foods they have in versus ones that aren't as processed, and then looking at their health outcomes. So this is where some of the initial concern has come, that some populations have had as much as, or some subgroups in our populations, 80% of their foods coming from ultra-processed foods, and finding a higher incidence of, you know, higher weights, perhaps diabetes, heart disease. Again, is that because those ultra-processed foods contain something? Or is it because they're not eating less processed foods, which have a lot of health benefits? That's what they're looking at.
How the heck do they do? I wonder how how they manage to do that research.
Well, they look at food records or dietary recalls, different ways that people report their food. That itself is somewhat problematic.
Yeah.
You know, trying to remember exactly and how much you ate. It's also a little problematic in that since ultra-processed food definition has to do with how processed it is, there are some foods where people scientists aren't agreeing whether to put them in ultra-processed or not. So it can be tricky work. The other thing that's always hard to control for in those kind of studies is, as you can imagine, if someone eats a diet with lots of whole foods, what we might consider a very healthy diet, they probably also don't drink a lot. They may exercise more. They're a little less likely to be a smoker. So sometimes it's hard to pick out what's diet and what is all the other things that they're doing.
Kevin in Gays Mills, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Larry. Enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I'm calling in response to a previous caller who asked about xanthan gum and gar gum and foods. And used in place of flour to thicken the product. And if a flour was in there, then people with gluten sensitivities and celiac disease cannot have that. So in order to make a product gluten-free, they use the gar gums and xanthan gums in place of a little bit of flour.
You know, and Kevin has indicated he's celiac. So interesting point there, Beth.
Yeah, excellent point. I haven't looked a lot at the gluten-free products to see what they put in them. But I think that would be an interesting exercise, is to pick up some of those, look at the ingredient list, and see, what is being substituted in to accommodate those people who can't use those products that would have wheat. So great point. Excellent point.
Washington Post just had published a piece on gluten and gluten. People with, say, thinking they needed a gluten-free diet. And about, I think the research was like 80% of those who thought they needed a gluten-free diet it wasn't a problem, really.
Yeah. You know, food.
I'm not saying that for you, Kevin.
And, you know, something like celiacs is usually, you know, people get diagnosed. They get a procedure done where the doctor diagnoses it. But there are other gluten intolerance, there's other intolerances, and those are harder to diagnose, and often people self-diagnose. They eat something, they don't feel good, so they don't eat it again. You know, if they can manage that and still have a healthy diet, I think that's fine. I also think the food industry, and I used to work in it, so I know a little bit of how it works, you know, did a pretty good job of promoting a lot of products as gluten-free as if they had some special health benefit for the general population. And so a lot of people began to think they needed those products when they maybe didn't.
Jay in Lake Geneva, we'll go to you. Hi, Jay.
Hi, I just wanted to make a few comments also about what you were just talking about also. You know, gluten, you know, celiac disease, diabetes, those aren't like diseases that you just get. They're just different degrees of it. You know, you can have gluten intolerance at different varying degrees, and then it gets to a certain threshold where they call it celiac disease, where your gut's just not working anymore. Same thing with diabetes. It's insulin resistance is what it is. And the reason you get insulin resistance is because you're bombarding your cells with sugar. and insulin, and they start shutting down receptors. And the more receptors you shut down, the more insulin your pancreas tries to make, and the more receptors get shut down, eventually you get diabetes. And now the problem with that is by eating refined carbohydrates. So I think what your show should be talking about is not the term ultra-processed, but ultra-refined carbohydrates, because that's what's killing people. That's what's causing diabetes. And also, you should talk about the seed oils, too, the rancid seed oils that people are eating.
Well, rancid seed oils. Well, Beth, go ahead and comment.
Yeah, he brings up excellent points. We do have a lot of type 2 diabetes. I want to make clear that's different from type 1 that often can occur in childhood, which has nothing to do with how people are eating or weight. And they need insulin. But type 2 diabetes, a strong driver is overweight and obesity. So often people, again, might have trouble handling glucose, so they're pre-diabetic. And with care with their diet and with weight loss, they can control that without progressing on to type 2 diabetes. So there's some debate about whether eating those carbohydrates is what's causing that overweight and obesity. Is it carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates? Refined ones don't have a lot of fiber. Does that make them palatable so people eat too much? We don't really fully understand that, but we know eating diets with more fiber and being careful about weight gain can really work for helping people to reduce their risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Now, there is a genetic component to that, and there are some people who develop type 2 diabetes who are not overweight, and that's, you know, just something that happens.
And we'll get to the rancid seed oils in just a minute. Beth Olson, our guest, associate professor and extension specialist in the Nutritional Sciences Department at UW-Madison. As we talk with her about processed foods, we've been looking at the ultra-processed foods, but taking some other questions as well relating to nutrition as we move along. You can join in, numbers 800-642-1234, or you could email us. Email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at processed foods today on the show and zeroed in a bit on ultra-processed foods with our guest Beth Olson from the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have Beth back. Join in with your own questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Just a quick mention, after noon today, we'll talk about technologies that help people with advanced heart failure. So that's at noon today. But right now, we're looking at food with Beth. The caller had a question or made a comment about rancid seed oils. You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'm not aware of people consuming a lot of rancid seed oils that it would cause a problem there. They would certainly develop an off flavor, and I would think people would notice that and not consume them. I know there's concern with seed oils, and some people think that we consume too much of them. One of the things we've done over the years, instead of just talking about how we should reduce certain fat levels in our diet, we've talked about the types of fats. And replacing some of the saturated fats, largely come from animals, with plant oils. Now, that would include seed oils, but we've also talked about ones that might be higher in omega-3. So avocados, fish. So these are monounsaturated fats, olive oil. So we've also talked about not just replacing your saturated fats with unsaturated, but looking at plant or others. But looking more at monounsaturated fats, because they also seem to be protective for heart health.
Yeah. Well, and here I'm thinking now we've zeroed in a little on ultra-processed food. Well, I would think oils would be an ultra-processed food.
Yeah, they might be. You know, that's interesting. I think Some might define it that way. Some of the scientists don't. And this is kind of this tricky part about ultra-processed foods. It's not just what's in the food. They actually talk about why. So if the sole purpose of the processing is to make the food more stable, and that would be true with oils, mm-hmm. or to make them edible, you know, we can't cook with a seed. We need the oil out of it. It needs to get extracted, crushed, pressed, whatever. Then they don't consider that ultra-processed. So you see the ultra-processed definition's a little tricky. Many of those scientists who are really looking at this talk about processed foods, and they talk about why they're processed, why the ingredients are used, and how they're packaged. So it's actually, they talk about the packaging as well. So you see that's not the food at all. So they're really talking about an entire category of a food as opposed to particular foods with ingredients in them.
Mary Kay in Kenosha has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I have a question about grocery store vegetables.
Yeah.
Why isn't there more squash varieties? Why isn't there Swiss chard and other vegetables that we can consume the tops of? You know, why they throw away the good part?
Yeah. All right.
Well, that's probably a question for the food scientists. I'm not sure if that has to do with demand. And perhaps there's more of those at particular stores that cater more to people who are interested in that. Or if it has to do with transportation and how those foods bear up or season. I don't know. I do know, you know, stores, again, having worked in a food company, stores work on supply and demand. If it doesn't sell, they don't stock it. So perhaps some of those items just aren't moving quickly enough.
And I just saw something the other day about the profit margin or the margin that grocery stores work on. And it's like 1.5% or something like that. It's a very small compared to probably my Apple computers.
Yeah. It is a very tight margin. And so we would hear that word, and I worked in the food industry, and we'd want to put in a new product. Well, they didn't want to take out a product that they knew was selling well in order to make space for our new one that they didn't know about, because if it didn't sell, they weren't going to make money, and their margins are very slim.
I wonder if that's why you see new and improved.
Yeah, attract attention. So it might be the same product with a little bit of difference. I think it's also why you see, we used to call them line extensions. You know, people trust this product, so let's make it in another flavor or package it in a different way because people will be familiar with it and choose it. And that, you know, a lot of our food choices, you know, our familiarity, how we grew up, what we're used to. And one of the things we'll sometimes do an extension when we're doing nutrition education is just set a goal for the week to try something different. Try a new vegetable. You know, try it once. See how you like it.
Yeah. Here's an email. What beverages, if any, count as ultra-processed foods?
So I think not ultra-processed, I believe, are things like coffee, tea, and water. Most everything after that they consider processed. I think 100% fruit juice would not be processed. But energy drinks, fruit drinks, soda pops, any of the drinks that begin to add sugar, for instance, even blended fruit drinks where they're adding a very concentrated fruit juice to make it sweeter, they would consider that an ultra-processed food.
Mm. Milk?
Here again is that definition. Milk is not considered ultra-processed, even if it's pasteurized, because again, the purpose of that was just to prevent, you know, potentially dangerous organisms from being in the milk. Now, if the milk, probably chocolate milk's considered processed because we've added sugar generally and flavor. So then they would move that over into ultra-processed.
Some ultra-processed foods are made to overcome your body's signals indicating that you're full, which leads to weight gain. Maybe talk about some examples of foods where it may be difficult to tell whether you're actually full.
Yeah. One, you know, that we've caution people to take care over time are liquids. So you can drink very quickly something like a soda pop and not realize how many calories came in from that. So that's one area. I think, you know, anybody would probably be inclined to eat a food if it's tasty. So ingredients are added to make foods tasty. Fat and sugar, of course, salt. And those are all ones that are marked as, when they're added for that purpose, to make the food taste better, they're considered ultra-processed. So I think I often also think about how quickly can you eat the food. So if you think of how quickly could you eat a cookie versus an apple, it takes a pretty long time to get, you know, as you'll find out when you eat all your fruit for lunch, to chew it, swallow it. It's got fiber and it's going to move through you more slowly. Those might be a little less of something you're going to overconsume, as opposed to something that doesn't have much fiber, chews up pretty quickly, you know, moves through pretty quickly.
Yeah, that cookie goes pretty fast.
Yeah.
I don't have one today, but...
Yeah, it's a food I find sometimes you can almost take your last bite and not realize you were eating it. You know, you went so quickly.
So ultra-processing changes the chemical structure of food, and I'm wondering, how does that affect the way our bodies absorb the food?
Oh, that's a good question. So it could change it in that, again, if you take out the fiber, we're going to probably digest and absorb that more quickly. You're going to get the calories out of an apple pastry probably more quickly than you would an apple that has the fiber in it. So that's one. The individual ingredients, you know, we're changing them to some degree. Some of them we're just changing them. They're still ingredients you would find in nature. We've just added more of them or enhanced them. So your digestion absorption of those probably doesn't change much. It might be what it pushes out, like fiber. It might be how quickly it comes in. So refined carbohydrates are going to come in more quickly, raise your blood sugar, drop it again more quickly than something less refined.
Tom sent an email. How dangerous is acrylamide that is in food and can harm us if heated to a certain temperature?
Okay, I can't answer that one. That would be for the food safety person. I think that's in the plastics that people are concerned about. Certainly wouldn't be something I'd want to consume. But I think just something I'd have to look more at about exactly where it's coming from and how to avoid it if that's what we need to do.
And another one, what are some examples of foods that have altered chemical structures?
So high fructose corn syrup is an excellent example. It's a sugar that's processed to increase the amount of fructose. What that does is fructose is sweeter than regular sugar, sucrose, so they can use less of it and make something sweeter. So that's a real common change. Another one has been the oils. They are oils are liquid. So if you put them into a food that you want to stay more solid, it'll make the food runny. So they'll hydrogenate those oils. They add hydrogens on. It makes it more like a solid fat. To make whatever the product is more solid.
Oh, man. So what role can the government play in addressing health concerns associated with ultra-processed foods?
So they can do a few things, whether they choose to do so or not. You know, that's another question. They have made regulations over time. So when you think of trans fats, those can be produced when we hydrogenate fats, and the government decided there's no need for those in our food, and they said we can't put them in anymore, and they came out. So they can do things like that. They can also do more in terms of dietary guidance, nutrition education. They've done a lot with regulations around school meals, saying, you know, they have to be whole grain, how much whole grains need to be in, how many fruits and vegetables can be in. So they can do a lot with those kind of programs, other government programs like WIC that provide foods for low-income families with small babies and children. Where we haven't gone is things like, you know, actually just forbidding certain ingredients as long as they're considered safe, or forbidding advertising. That's just not something that's been done in the U.S.
I wonder how much corn syrup is consumed by the average person in the course of a year.
Yeah, I don't know. I suspect that you get a kind of an uneven distribution. I think people who use sweetened sodas, you know, not diet sodas, probably skew us towards the high end because of that. And then everybody else is probably distributed down, and it probably has a lot to do with how many processed foods.
And what about diet drinks? Are there concerns relating to diet Pepsi or Coke or whatever diet drink?
Yeah, those ingredients have been shown to be safe. There is concern that generally when they're approved for a purpose. Then once they're in the food supply, they can be put anywhere. So people probably consume a lot more of them than they used to. There's some concern that it teaches us to expect, for instance, things to be sweet. But there isn't real strong evidence that if you use them, at least sparingly, that there's a problem.
Not everyone has access to food that are not as processed. I mean, it's kind of, we're getting at that. Or the time it always takes to make meals at home. What are some tips for choosing foods that are both convenient and good for you?
Well, you can check the ingredient list, look at the nutrition facts panel, and then some of it can be addressed by planning ahead. So if you have the ability to have things in your pantry or your freezer, having frozen or canned fruits and vegetables that you can use as if you don't have fresh or don't have access, or have them to cook with, or time, you know, convenience is tough. For many people, working and kids and activities, commuting, whatever it may be, you know, do you have time on the weekend to cook and freeze and just heat it up for dinner? Or do you supplement maybe you have time to steam vegetables for dinner that's fresh, but you pick an entree that's frozen. So you're balancing out, you know, in this particular meal, can I use a processed food and one that's less processed to help myself out?
Jeff Robbins, our technical director, has a reminder every day about what day it is for the year. And today is Happy National TV Dinner Day. And I heard on the radio this morning about TV dinners that were first, I think, today was the day that Swanson or whoever it was came out with their first TV dinner. And then it went on for about, they were called TV dinners for a few years, but then the companies wanted to change the name to something that sounded better. But TV dinner is stuck anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I haven't looked at TV dinners in quite a while. They've certainly evolved over time. There's certainly a variety. You can get ones that have targets to try to make them healthier, less fat, less sodium. And then you have some that are really targeted at big meals and people who, you know, are looking for something hearty. You know, I would want to read those labels carefully. But I think we see less TV dinners, perhaps, because there are, you know, quite a variety of other packaged foods that we can make up our own TV dinners, if you will. The idea of having to have, you know, four or five food groups all in one tray to heat in the oven isn't probably as prevalent as it used to be.
Well, it's there's certainly, if you go to Woodman's grocery store, there's an aisle that is about 100 feet long, and it's full of TV dinners down one side. And if you go down the other side of that same aisle, you've got at least 100 feet of pizza.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, pizza might be that ultimate TV dinner. And I think those are examples of what people would consider ultra-processed foods. And if we're consuming a lot of them, you know, we might not be getting enough of other things that we need. So certainly, you know, there's occasions and there's times where all those foods are helpful. You, even among those, you can maybe make some choices. So take a look at the two TV dinners and say, which one has more fiber? Which one looks like it actually has fruits and vegetables in it or whatever?
Jeff did a little research here. The Swanson TV dinner hit grocery store cases on September 10th of 1953. Ah. An immediate success in 1954, Swanson sold more than 10 million units. And the next year, it sold 25 million units.
Wow.
And then, of course, a lot of other people, companies got on board.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. It's an amazing amount. Beth Olson, our guest today, associate professor and extension specialist in the Department of Nutritional Sciences at UW-Madison. Talking nutrition with her, we've been zeroing in a bit on ultra-processed foods, but taking other questions as well or comments, maybe your own experiences, love to hear from you. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller with my guest, extension specialist in nutritional sciences, Beth Olson, also an associate professor. It's great to have her back. Questions or comments or maybe an experience to share, the number's 800-642-1234. The email address, talk@WPR.org. Some information, conservative estimate on the consumption of high fructose corn syrup indicates a daily average of 132 kilocalories for all Americans aged of greater than two. And the top 20% of consumers of caloric sweeteners ingest 316 kilocalories.
Yeah, that's, again, those probably top end might be heavy soda pop users or other sweetened beverages. That's, you know, a real common use. But small amounts of it are used in many products. So it doesn't surprise me that, you know, we consume a fair bit of it.
Yeah, for sure. Jay in Two Rivers has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jay.
Well, to replace ultra-processed foods, especially things with sugar and sweeteners, so-called natural but non-nutritional sweeteners like erythritol, stevia, monk fruit. I understand that some of those also have problems for diabetics, that or some may have heart health problems. I don't know if that's on topic enough. Is there anything you might have to say about somebody trying to cut down on sugar?
Mm. Yeah, and there's just been a proliferation of alternative sweeteners, so things besides sugar. Sometimes they're called artificial. Some of them promote themselves as being more natural. They are sugars that are modified, perhaps, so we don't absorb them as well. Or there's high intensity, so you can use just a tiny amount and get a lot of sweetness, and that's how they reduce calories. I think I would look at how people are using them. If you are a big soda pop consumer, sugared, and you're worried, maybe you start with a soda pop with artificial sweetener, and then maybe you alternate that with water. And so maybe it's a way to start reducing the sugars that you have in your diet. And then eventually, hopefully, replacing those calories, if you need them, with something healthier. So it might be milk or juice or tea or, you know, fruit, something else besides soda. But I do think we've talked so much about the dangers of sugars that we've almost promoted the use of other alternatives, which aren't always, you know, necessarily healthier.
For sure. Jay, thanks for calling. Chris and Adams, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I had a healthcare crisis in January where I almost died. My stomach started bleeding. And I had a long conversation with the doctor at the hospital, and I already had been on Dr. Weil's 10 things you should eat every day, minus the whole grains because I'm celiac, and I don't eat any processed foods. I never did. But all I did was shift my vegetable and fruit consumption to the 10 vegetables that you should eat every day. And the weight came off, and I lost 60 pounds. And I didn't even try. I wasn't hungry. Every time I felt a craving, I went for an orange or something, and a pineapple. And it just, it's been heaven, and I've got some more weight to lose, but I'm not worrying about it. One of the main problems is when you're on a diet and you're trying to lose weight is the anxiety that comes from the fact that you might put some sugar in your mouth or something. Anyway,
Chris, thank you so much for calling. Comments, Beth?
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you're doing better. That's just wonderful to hear. Something I always think is kind of interesting about fruit is one of the dietary patterns recommended by the federal government in our dietary guidance, the Mediterranean diet and others, talk about desserts and how often they use fruit instead of something else. And, you know, she was mentioning reaching for a piece of fruit. A lot of fruit is very sweet, but it comes with fiber, with lots of nutrients. You know, look at the colors of fruits and vegetables. Those are all nutrients. Again, takes you a little longer to eat, chew. There are excellent alternatives to picking up something else with added sugar that might not have all those, probably doesn't have all those nutrients.
Yeah. Chris, thank you very much. Ben emailed, are vegan-specific ultra-processed foods, are there ones to stay away from, like tofu and similar products, or accidental vegan items like Oreos?
I think it's true of any food you label. Just because it has a label on it, gluten-free, vegan, even, you know, natural, doesn't mean the food itself is, you know, all that healthy. You just have to look at the ingredient list. You know, some people are concerned with not consuming animal products, and for them, some of these vegan products may be, you know, good alternatives. I would look at the ingredient listing. Some of the vegan products have a lot of what would be considered ultra-processed ingredients and be considered an ultra-processed food, and may not by default be better for you than the animal alternative.
Yeah.
But if you're choosing to not use animal products, they may be a good substitute.
Here's another email. Are frozen vegetables better for you than canned?
That's a good question. I don't know that they are. I would say that many people think they aren't as good as fresh, the frozen and canned. Often, or sometimes, be careful what I say here, vegetables or fruits are frozen in the field practically. I mean, very quickly, which preserves a lot of the nutrients. What you want to look for is what else might be in that package. So there are frozen vegetables with sauces added, so that's going to add, you know, calories and fat. There are fruits that are canned in heavy syrup, so they've got a lot of added sugar. So watch what is in the can and what is in the package. And then, again, those are great alternatives to fresh if you need them.
And I would think that there's, if you're canning, there's heat. And heat may have some degree on certain items that may be part of the, you know, vitamins or whatever that might be part of the vegetable.
Certainly, that could be true. What we will talk about often is if you have the choice, so, you know, a canned, you may prefer the fresh for that reason. If you're thinking about, well, I don't have anything to add to dinner except a canned vegetable, then add that. That's better than not having a vegetable. So I think they're good alternatives with some trade-offs.
Michael called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if you could address the processing degree of beer, wine, and distilled alcoholic beverage.
So I can't. I'm not an expert in alcohol. I would say when I've read some scientific articles on classifying alcohol, it was pretty complicated. So some alcohol fell in as an ultra-processed food and some did not. An alternative suggested by one nutritionist was simply to remove them entirely from the conversation. Treat them as a whole separate thing that you deal with in terms of their use in the diet and whether they're, you know, appropriate or not.
So when you go to the grocery store, there's a million things to choose from. What's the best approach for finding something good for you and that avoids some of the things we've been talking about?
So if you can, you know, it depends on where you're able to shop, how often you're able to get there. It's often been said, shop the outside of the aisles. That's where the fruits, vegetables, dairy products are. Down the center are going to be your packaged items that you might want to choose less of. I'd say look in the frozen section for things like frozen fruits and vegetables that you can use in cooking. And then after that, I'd say read the labels within the category of interest to you. If you want to eat ready-to-eat cereal because it's fast and, you know, in the morning, pick up something you think you'd like and then pick up other brands and take a look. Does it have fiber? How many calories does it have? Is it fortified? Same with breads. The same with soups. Pick it up and take a look. How much sodium? And compare within those and make the best choice that you can. And then take a look at, you know, the cost. That's a real concern for many people, especially these days. We're hearing grocery prices are high. And so can you find what's on sale and take a look? And maybe one week you pick a different vegetable because that's the frozen one that's on sale or the fresh one that's on sale versus another week.
You mentioned cereals. Mark had emailed us, where do Cheerios fall on the good foods scale?
Generally, they're, you know, pretty good food. They're made with oats. They're fortified, which in the U.S. diet, we rely on fortification for some of our vitamins and minerals. They're low in fat. Of course, for kids, they're good finger food. So it's actually a favorite snack in our house is Cheerios with milk.
Well, it's I kind of like Cheerios myself, as a matter of fact. Well, so the food pyramid.
Yeah, that's gone.
Yeah, is gone.
We grew up with the food pyramid. Before that, the basic four, you might remember. As we learned more, I think one of the things that happened, and this was true with the pyramid, we tried to cram everything into this one figure, and it got really confusing. And so now we have what's called My Plate, which is a pretty simple representation of fruits, vegetables, dairy, our basic food groups, and how much of each of those to have. And then we focus more on doing nutrition education to tell people how to put that into practice.
Well, Beth, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. Appreciate it very much.
Okay, I'll look forward to it, too. Thank you.
Beth Olson, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the Nutritional Science Department at UW-Madison. Great to have her with us. Just wanted to mention, tomorrow on the show, our team is traveling to La Crosse. We'll talk about the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. It's celebrating 100 years of conservation, and then we'll learn how the city of La Crosse is creating more opportunities for outdoor recreation. That's tomorrow. Coming up, though, we're going to talk about treatments for advanced heart failure. We'll talk with a doctor about that, and you'll learn more in just a couple of minutes. I'm Larry Mueller for Wisconsin Public Radio News. thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And this segment, we're talking about heart health and treatment options for advanced heart failure. Our guests, we have three guests for you today, Roger and Rochelle Thompson, live in Pickerel, and Roger recently received treatment for advanced heart failure. Roger, welcome. Thank you for joining in today.
Thank you very much. It's good to talk.
Yeah, and Rochelle, thank you so much as well.
Well, thank you.
We'll hear some more from them as we go along during the show. Also with us, Dr. Vijay Krishnan, also known as Dr. Vijay. He's a board-certified advanced heart failure cardiologist, serves as medical director of the Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin's Mechanical Circulatory Support Program. Dr. Vijay, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you. Thank you, team. Thank you for having us today.
Well, great to have you, all three of you here. And as we talk with our three guests today and you're listening in, I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're managing life with some heart failure issues. What treatment options are you exploring? Want to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Vijay, let's start with you. What is advanced heart failure?
So advanced heart failure is also known as end-stage heart failure. So people who are diagnosed of a weak heart with guideline-directed treatment, medical treatment, including a device which is called an ICD or CRT. If those patients start feeling more symptoms, like more breathing trouble, more leg swelling, had to go up on the doses of the current medicines. Sometimes patients cannot tolerate the medicines they were able to tolerate 6 months ago or a year ago. If they are getting readmitted to hospital multiple times for heart failure, we say at least once every 6 months or so. Or else sometimes patients will have rhythm issues like ventricular tachycardia, where the heart rhythm goes into trouble, and then we had to give ICD shocks. These are the things we look for to distinguish between simple heart failure versus advancement towards an end stage of heart failure.
And do we know the causes of advanced heart failure?
Yes. So the main causes are any heart attack in the past, any blockages in the arteries which are not fixed on time. That can cause the heart tissue to die, and over a period of time, it can progress into heart failure. The other causes could be simple viral infections, parvovirus, even COVID infections have resulted in heart failure. So that is another possibility. We also have genetic conditions which can cause muscle injury or muscle disease in the heart. We have conditions like sarcoidosis, amyloidosis. These are other infiltrated that is volant in the heart, which can cause advanced heart failure.
And so the advanced heart failure, essentially it means that conventional heart therapies and symptom management strategies are no longer working, if I have it right.
Yes, yes.
So the treatment, what are the treatment strategies for heart failure?
So when we start with the diagnosis of heart failure, we start with medical treatment, go over couple of types of medicines, like including beta blockers, aldosterone antagonist, ARNI, MRAs, and SGLT2 inhibitors. So these are the basic core medicines we use to help with symptom management and help to recover the heart function. We also have diuretics to help with extra fluid the heart is not able to handle. And that is also part of the main treatment. once we do that for 3 to 6 months and see whether we can titrate the medicines to what is required as optimal treatment, and we check the heart function again and see whether the heart function is getting better, the patients are getting better. If they are getting better, that is a good thing. We can watch and do medical treatment. If we do not see improvement or if the patient is feeling more symptomatic, then we look at further testing in the form of catheterization, where we measure the pressures in the heart as well as pressure in the lungs. Is pushed around every minute in the body. We also have a stress test called the cardiopulmonary exercise test, which also looks at the heart and the lungs together. And these are the way we look at the management plan and closely, serially follow the patients.
Well, I have a friend who had a heart transplant, and I'm wondering, obviously, one way to treat advanced heart failure is heart transplantation. What determines whether someone is or is not a candidate for a transplant?
It's a very good question, Mr. Larry. So heart transplant is one of the surgical treatment options for end-stage heart failure. And this is available for most of the individuals. One of the cutoffs we do, or one of the indices determined by the fact that patient is a younger patient, anybody more than 70 to 74 years of age, we do not offer. Some programs can offer up to 75. Ours is 72 to 74. If you are robust, we offer heart transplants. So age is one of the factors. If you have any active or recurrent cancer or high lung pressures independent of heart pressures, that means your lung is also involved, or you have other organ failures like liver failure or kidney failure, which needs more than one organ to be transplanted, that makes it a little more in-depth discussion. One other very important factor is if you cannot wait for getting through to a heart transplant. So some patients qualify, but they are very sick and they do not have a leisure of waiting for months to get to a heart transplant. And one other thing we look at is your diabetes well controlled, your nutrition is good, you are not too much obese. So some of the substance abuses, we need to make sure they are inactive. That means you're not using tobacco or similar products. So those kind of things factor into the candidacy for heart transplantation.
Roger Thompson, I want to turn to you. What was your life like when you lived with advanced heart failure?
I started my issues in 2002 with viral heart failure. I had everything else was fine. Veins and arteries were all good. I just had a virus attack the heart. Took me down to about 30% of heart function in 2002. And I got back to about 50%. And I did real well with that. And in the last 4 or 5 years, it started declining. I got down to 30% of heart function, and I was marginal. But then it got down to 10% of heart failure. I was still able to somewhat function, but it put me into the heart failure clinic, and that's where the LVAD device was recommended and installed.
And Rochelle, this got to be hard for you, or was hard for you. How did you and Roger work to keep things positive after Roger was diagnosed with advanced heart failure?
It changed a little bit, but I would always tell myself, somebody out there has it worse than you guys do. So that kept us going.
Well, it's a good way to look at it, for sure. Dr. Vijay, let's talk more about that, the left ventricular assist device. Explain what it is.
So as the name sounds, or expansion is, so the heart failure, the heart has two major chambers, the right side and the left side. and two collecting chambers on the right and left side. So the main pumping chamber for the heart is the left ventricle, and that pumps the blood to the rest of the body, makes you feel energetic, and blood flow goes to the rest of the organs. So when that organ or that side of the heart fails, the heart does not pump blood out. So what left ventricular assist device does, it is actually a heart pump. So it is implanted surgically, open heart surgery, which takes around 4 to 6 hours. We place a mechanical pump very close to the heart with a graft, which actually goes into the heart, takes the blood from the heart, and pumps it to the aorta, which is the main artery which comes out of the heart. And that's how the patients get the relief from the congestion as well as get the energy, because the blood is flowing in the right direction to the rest of the body.
Oh, so that device, are there many ways that it can be used for treating advanced heart failure?
So we usually use it to support the left side of the heart. From time to time, it could be used to support the right side of the heart. But most of the time, it is used as a temporary device at that point. We do not make it as a permanent option on the right side of the heart. It is more tuned to work in the left side of the heart.
That makes sense. And you know, I guess I'm not surprised at myself, but I was not aware of this device. How long has the left ventricular assist device been around?
So the trial started in the late 1990s, and in 2000 we started the implant. That is called the first generation of the heart pump, which used to be weighing around 5 pounds, and it used to sit in the abdomen because it was huge, so it couldn't sit in the chest. From there, we went to the second and third generation, and now we are at the fourth generation of the pump, which is actually magnetically levitated. And it has less moving parts and less contact with the blood. So bleeding and the pump clotting is very minimal. And we are at that fourth generation pump currently in the United States.
Roger, what kind of care were you receiving before you had your left ventricular assist device surgery?
I had standard cardiology visits and everything. I also have a pacemaker defibrillator, which was installed in 2002 when all my heart failure started. But virtually cardio visits every 6 months. I've done pretty well, still active and everything, and been active all the way through this. Hasn't slowed me down greatly, although Dr. Vijay has some no-nos for me, but I keep going.
And how did you find out about these devices and that it was an option for you?
Well, up here, I was being handled by a Spirus, and after I'd done cardio rehab with them, it was determined that I was in what would be called cardiac failure. And that sent me to a couple places. I could either go to Frederick or UW-Madison or the Mayo Clinic, and Frederick worked for me. So that probably got shifted over to Frederick, and they totally handle the LVAD. Nobody else really in this area does anything with it.
Boris in Wausau has a question for us. Let's go. Well, I'll tell you what, we'll get to that in just a minute. Just a reminder that we have three guests for you today: Dr. Vijay, cardiologist at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin; Roger Thompson, received a left ventricular assist device actually in 2023, and Rochelle Thompson, married to Roger and supported him through his recovery. They are our guests, and you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking about a mechanical device that really offers another option for people diagnosed with advanced heart failure. Our guest, Dr. Vijay, cardiologist at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin; Roger Thompson received one of those devices called a left ventricular assist device. He received it in 2023, and Rochelle Thompson, married to Roger, supported him through his recovery. Again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And now, Boris and Wausau, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. My name is Boris Ackman. I'm actually a cardiac anesthesiologist. I used to work on the East Coast in a busy transplant center, practicing now in Wisconsin, actually in Wausau. And my question is regarding the use of heart failure medications in our population, because from what I think, that some of the medications are underused, for example, the SGLT2 inhibitors that you mentioned, Dr. Vijay, as well as just simple medications like aldactone, that when we see patients with lower EFs, it is more often than not that they are not on perfect medications, be it that they are in the North Woods where they don't have easy access to advanced heart failure cardiology, or financial reasons, because SGLT2 inhibitors still are very, very expensive. And how does this compare to other countries where there's heart failure treatment maybe available to a lesser amount? And that is my comment and question.
All right, Boris, thank you. Dr. Vijay, comment.
Thank you for joining us. So heart failure treatment, as I mentioned, it's not without side effects as well as the expense part too. So we usually, with the stronger medicines, the beta blockers, the aldosterone antagonists and ARNI type of medicines, especially aldactone, which is one of the medicines mentioned, and SGLT2 inhibitors, Jardiance and Farxiga, are the two types of medicines available. They have to be carefully used in select populations. So we recommend before getting out of the hospital, if the diagnosis was made in a hospital, that we try to attempt to start these medicines and apply for some sort of assistance if the cost is prohibitive. So ideally, yes, all the four medicine groups, if we can start on a patient and start titrating on an outpatient basis, that is an ideal situation. Now, if we have insurance coverage issues or cost prohibitions, we have to work with what we have. That is the unfortunate state. But I think there are programs where you can get samples, but they are not without an end date. So I completely understand the dilemma that we need all these medicines, but some of them still have some coverage issues.
Yeah. And I'm wondering about the device. Can that be at least partially covered by insurance?
So the LVAD, if you're asking about that, yes. So we have a robust team at Fredet MCW who will take a look at people with their insurance, their coverage, and we apply for disability if that is needed, if we apply for assistance if that is needed. So we will support as much as we can if the patient is a good candidate and the patient and the family says, yes, we would like to pursue this. So we have some assistance programs, and we'll do whatever we could in our capacity to support that from happening.
Yeah. Boris, thanks again. Sid in Janesville, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Sid.
Hi. I just wanted to share that I've had a kind of heart failure. I had two heart valves replaced along with a blockage behind the heart cleared up. And that operation happened in January of 2019, and I've been surviving okay. We had to make some adjustments to my medications along the way, but other than that, I haven't had any problems. I was having some problems before that, obviously, with all those problems, but I try to walk 3 miles a day in three separate one-mile walks, and the one medication that had to be adjusted is something called Tamsulosin. No, not Tamsulosin. It was and it manages the pace of the heart.
Mm.
Yeah, metoprolol.
Metoprolol. Yeah. Well, so a reasonably good outcome. And Dr. Vijay, I think we've made a whole lot of progress over the years in dealing with the heart.
Yes. So all these medicines started in 1970s with the initial trials with beta blockers. Then in 80s, the ACE inhibitors were developed and trialed. The ARBs were developed at the same time. In 1990s, we saw all the big trials for the beta blockers. The metoprolol is one of them. And towards the end of 1990s is when the aldactone trial came, digoxin trial came. The RNA, which is one of the newer medicines, came in later half of 2000 to 2010. And then recently, if you ask me, like, we have been plowing through and making good progress in the field.
Yeah, it sounds that way for sure. Sid, thank you very much for your call. Roger, I want to go back to you. Now you had this device put in. What was the recovery process like after the surgery?
Well, it was a total open heart surgery, so they split your whole rib cage. It was almost a 2-week hospital stay. I think I did very well in recovery. I was able to walk around after a couple of days and just kept walking more and more at the hospital. Got out kind of in record time. I did have a little bit of a bump in the road. I had to go back in for a while. I did have some internal bleeding and some fluid on the lungs, but that got solved, and overall, that was about it. So it's about a 2 to 4 week recovery, in my opinion.
And I mean, compare your life now versus before this.
I'm still very active. I obviously can't be in water, can't swim or anything, or bathtub. The main thing for me is that you are either carrying around the 5-pound battery pack, and you have the cable coming out of your belly about by your belly button, or at night I am plugged into basically a 25-foot extension cord that plugs into the wall. That's a control unit for nighttime. So it's a bit of an adjustment, but it's much better than the alternative.
Yeah. And Rochelle, what should family members, or what was it like for you, and what should family members or caregivers expect as their loved ones heals from left ventricular assist device surgery?
It's a lot of worry. My thing is that I had to change his bandage and make sure there was no infection going around the tube. And I think my biggest fear was I was going to screw it up somehow.
Yeah.
You know, and it took me a long time to get over that. And now I look back at it and think to myself, why were you so upset with this? So you just got to learn to take one day at a time.
And it sounds like the daily or the upkeep, I'm wondering what kind of upkeep does the device require? Is it, well, it sounds like it's daily in some ways, but then there may be monthly things as well.
I believe it was like every 3 days where I had to change it in the beginning. And now it's like once a week. So, and once you get over the fear of not screwing things up, it's a piece of cake now. it's just part of your routine.
Yeah. Mary Beth called, couldn't stay with us. Mary Beth from Boulder Junction. She says the Inflation Reduction Act reduced the cost of her husband's heart medication, and that was a huge help. Dr. Vijay, comment on that?
statins, and it has been recognized as one of the most common cost for the healthcare if we are not treating heart failure properly. So today we are getting more support till the newer medicines are a little bit exempt from that. So they have some years they can charge more, and then they come to a baser or lesser price for the public. So definitely, yes, the programs, government programs are helping the patients throughout the heart failure phases.
Yeah. Dr. Vijay, cardiologist at Frater of the Medical College of Wisconsin, Roger Thompson, who's had the left ventricular assisted device installed, and Rochelle Thompson, married to Roger and supported him through his recovery. Questions about heart health as we move along, you can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And I've been asked to mention that tonight at 8 o'clock, I hope you'll tune in to WPR for live coverage of the ABC News presidential debate simulcast from NPR. Former President Donald Trump is the Republican candidate. Of course, the Democratic candidate is Vice President Kamala Harris. It's scheduled to take place in Philadelphia, and our NPR's Mary Louise Kelly hosts this live special coverage, and NPR correspondents who cover politics will offer their analysis and help put the debate into perspective during this election season. So tune in for the ABC News presidential debate simulcast from NPR. Starts at 8 o'clock tonight here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. In the meantime, questions, give a call as we talk about heart health with our guests. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Dr. Vijay, why should people prioritize heart health? It's something that I guess we don't think a whole lot about when things are going well. So talk with us about that.
First and foremost, even before you're born and taking the first breath, the heart is pumping the blood around. So that is a pump which is working even when you are with your mom. So I think it's one of the key factors of improving or giving blood flow to the rest of the body to make sure you're functioning well. Your other organs are also dependent on the blood flow. So it is like a machine, which technically there is a reason why we say the heart of the machine, because that's how the heart is to the body. So the key things we need to be careful is that even if when you go to a routine exam and you find that you have a kidney problem or a liver problem, and unless and until you have a specific reason to have that, you always have to make sure that the heart is working fine. You know, so that's why a visit to the primary care is what we recommend on an annual basis. And if there is any symptoms like leg swelling or fatigue, unexplained fatigue, or breathing trouble, lightheaded, dizzy spells, any of those things happen, it is worthwhile to have a discussion with your primary doctor as a starting point. And if your primary doctor feels that, hey, maybe you need to see a heart doctor, get a checkup, I would recommend that to happen. You know, we live in a world where we are surrounded by processed food and lack of exercise. As our grandparents did more walking exercises, we don't do that much. So a lot of things can contribute to us developing heart problems down the line.
Vern in Boyd called but couldn't stay with us. He's wondering about the side effects of heart medications and which are best combinations in terms of health. He thinks the ANG2 blockers are the best. Would you comment on that, Dr. Vijay?
Yes. So I always say patients don't read textbooks when they're sick. So I always try to tailor the treatment for a particular patient. Some patients are able to tolerate one medicine more than the other. So it is trial and error, which is a scientific way of doing it. With Mr. Thompson also, with Roger also, we did the same. We tried some medicines to make sure he is able to tolerate. So we do that with every patient. We try to understand what their body needs are, and some of the medicines patients are able to tolerate. Now, when we say not able to tolerate, we look at a few things. One is symptoms. That is, if the patient is getting lightheaded, low blood pressures, or fatigue, the beta blockers can cause them. But some other medicines like ARNI or MRAs, the aldosterone antagonist, those medicines can affect the kidney. So we had to watch the kidney function very closely while we are on this medicine too. So there are some clinical monitoring as well as some lab monitoring we do. In addition to every 6 months to a year, we check the heart function to make sure are we making good progress in these situations.
Someone else is wondering about heart, about blood pressure and relationship to heart issues. If the blood pressure is high or low.
So, one of the most common causes of heart failure is high blood pressure. On long-term, high blood pressures can affect the heart, and then heart can sort of weaken over a period of time. So when we start, we may be having high blood pressures, and that is one of the reasons why we try to treat them, both with the diet as well as with medicines. When you are advancing into end-stage heart failure, what you will be facing is more like low blood pressure because your heart is not able to pump that well. And you will not be able to produce that much of a high blood pressure. So we are looking at hypotension, lightheaded disease, well, some people pass out. So those kind of things are more common when the heart is getting more and more tired with the pumping function.
And what should you, and so if you are, let's say it's a warm day and you're outside a bit and you feel a little lightheaded, is this a clue that maybe you ought to be going and seeing your doctor?
If it is one-off event and if you could explain like, oh, I was not hydrated properly, and also depending on like whether you have any other comorbidities, like if you have any other disease problems, that helps. But if this is a one-off episode, just watch it, discuss with family so somebody other than you know that this happened. But if this is happening more often and not related to a very hot day out there, then it is worth discussing with your primary doctor as a starting point.
John in Sun Prairie has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, doctor. And just had a question as to what is qualified for being in this heart failure status. Is this like a CF or EF value done with an electrocardiogram or the other electro tests that they do for heart where they test for how strong your heart is pumping?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are a couple of ways we could assess that. So one is the heart pumping is down, that is low ejection fraction, which could be assessed based on an echocardiogram, which is an ultrasound of the heart. That will look at both the right and left sides and look at the valves, whether there is any leaky valves, all those things we could understand. Now, certain other patients may not have a weak heart, but may have a stiff heart. Like people with sarcoidosis or amyloidosis, they are infiltrative heart disease, and they may have a good pumping heart, but they may have a bad relaxation. They may have problems like rhythm issues, like ventricular tachycardia. So Those patients, we also look at the EKG. We make sure we check whether there is any other rhythm issues. So it is a clinical diagnosis supported by investigations. That is the best way I could put it to explain heart failure.
John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Taking a look at heart health on the program and looking at this left ventricular assist device, but talking about heart issues in general with our guest today, Dr. Vijay, cardiologist at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin, and Roger and Rochelle Thompson. Roger received a left ventricular device in 2023, and of course, Rochelle is married to Roger and supports him through his recovery. Again, you can reach us at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at heart health on the program today with our three guests. Great to have them with us. Just a note, tomorrow on the show, our team is traveling to La Crosse. Looking forward to that. We'll talk about the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. It's celebrating 100 years of conservation. And then learn how the city of La Crosse is creating more opportunities for outdoor recreation. That's tomorrow at 11 on the show. Right now, though, heart health. Marty has a question, emailed with a question for Roger. Did you have to change your diet at all through your heart health journey?
Yeah, I'm supposed to. Generally, I do pretty well, but I certainly avoid salt, caffeine, alcohol 100% as much as possible. I do wander into the ice cream container once in a while, which is probably not the best for me, but I've been holding a pretty healthy weight. I've been around the 210 mark post-surgery, so I don't think I do real bad, and I do exercise a fair amount.
Yeah. Rochelle, have you had to make any changes in your own life in relation to Roger's situation?
I had to learn not to cook with salt anymore. And now when we do taste something and it's like in a restaurant, it's like the salt is way too much for us. So it makes you wonder all the salt that's in all the foods. You know, I had to do a lot of reading of the labels and, yeah, it took a time, but now it's, you know, it's easy. But, yeah, you have to learn a few things.
And get used to a few changes at least from the sound of it.
Well, you actually don't need salt. So,
is there anything else you do what do you do to spice your food up then?
I use a lot of spices, different types of spices, to give it more flavor, and use chives and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a trick, and you learn on the way if it's good or not.
Jeannie in Lake Geneva has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi. My question is if the doctor has had any experience using a device called Furosix, which allows the patient to deliver sub-Q doses of furosemide rather than going in the hospital for an IV when they get out of control using orals or can't take orals for some reason.
Yeah, Dr. Vijay?
Hi, thank you for that question. So the approved doses of Furosix is very minimal. If we are looking at option of needing IV diuretics, we try to provide it in the clinic setting itself rather than being admitted to the hospital. On an outpatient basis, like at home kind of a thing, so we do not have a very long-term data on that. We have that medicine available, but at a lower doses. Definitely there are medicines like Bumex or bumetanide or torsamide or Demidex. So these medicines are more powerful and better absorbed through as a pill compared to the Lasix or the furosemide. So we usually try to use Bumex or torsamide as an alternative if we are having less effect with Lasix or furosemide. We have a heart failure clinic, so we are a little biased in saying that we can provide IV diuretics in our clinic situations. Most of the cardiology clinics are able to provide that too. So we are not using the Furosix as the option when we need an IV diuretics.
All right, Jeannie, thank you.
Available in the conversation.
Yeah, thank you very much, Jeannie, for calling. How long, here's another email, how long can people survive once they've been diagnosed with congestive heart failure?
So if all depends on the stages. If you are diagnosed initially with heart failure and it's not very severe, needing hospitalizations or using heart pumping medicines called inotropes, we do a trial with medical therapy. As with Mr. Thompson, we did the primary cardiologist, Dr. Paul Kliffmeier. He did a wonderful job of keeping him away from me for almost 20 years by doing medical treatment. So we tried that as the first line of treatment option. If these, the tricky part is to identify when things are not being controlled with the medical treatment. If we are diagnosing somebody with end-stage heart failure, we are looking at 50% survival in 6 months' time. And that is where the heart pump and heart transplant options become important for the patient.
Yeah, I 6 month time, I that's for sure. You mentioned, here's another email, you mentioned processed foods and lack of exercise. What role does alcohol play?
Alcohol plays a big role if you are not doing rare social events. So high alcohol can affect both sides of the heart. It can cause the heart to dilate. And when the heart starts dilating, they become not very functional because the muscles don't contract properly. We see situations when young patients who have alcohol history, and I mean heavy history, they get into heart failure, and once we start the heart medicines and they quit the alcohol completely, we see a recovery of the heart back to normal if they didn't have any other insults to the heart. So, yes, I don't drink, so I don't know what to say, how much you can drink, but I would avoid as much as possible. Our patients are very happy to do that, especially when they know that they had to see less of the doctors. So it is a win-win both ways.
Oh, here's another email for Rochelle or Roger. Do you have any dishes to recommend?
Eat a lot of fish and chicken, I guess. And I guess the best advice is to look at the foods you're buying and see how much sodium's in there. I mean, I was shocked at some of the stuff that I thought was good. So, yeah. I don't know. Everybody's taste is different. So, yeah.
Well, there's nothing wrong with fish or chicken, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he'll eat a good hamburger. So, but we tend to stay away from broth. He'll have them once in a while, but not as much as he used to. So, you learn.
Okay. I wondered how you were going to answer that, but you did a pretty good job of answering that. Are there... Dr. Vijay, how many people have you worked with this left ventricular assist device? And obviously, it's something that you, well, you probably don't want to do it. You probably don't want to have to put it in anyone, but you have to sometimes. And I'm wondering about the success rate with the left ventricular assist device.
So I started practicing 14-15 onwards, 2014-15, and we have the newest generation of the heart pump since 2018, if you say. So I feel that patients have a very good quality of life after the heart pump, and Johnson are an example of that. When we all work as a team, we succeed, and that is all kudos to the team. From our side, the coordinators are doing the heavy lifting, who are always for the patients 24/7. We give them a number to call us if there is any questions. So people like Ms. Tania, Ms. Kathleen, they are our coordinators, and they are very helpful in this endeavor. And the most important is the patient and the family. So without them, we are not successful. And I have always been blessed that whenever I see the success, I always have the patient and their spouse standing next to them, or their daughter or son or father or mother. You know, they all, as a team, we succeed. If you ask me what is the longevity, what is the complication rate, since the initial pump in 2000, we have come a long way. Our survival is almost 70% to 75% in the first 2 years, which is more than the national average. Our FREDET system data is that. And we have 50 to 60% survival by year five. Some of the reason why the survival cannot be fully assessed is because sometimes we do the heart pump as a bridge to transplant. Down the line, transplant, so we have to take them away from the equation. So we have very good success rate. We are currently taking care of 33 heart pumps in our program, and we are expanding. So we are expecting more and more success with the technology as we have now. And the support team deserves a big kudos. So is the surgeon, Dr. Durham, and the team. So I would say, like, it's always a pleasure to work with the patient and the family, especially Mr. Thompson is, because it's always fun to have him. And I always jokingly say, you know, you put a device and knock on wood, no readmissions. No, they are not in the hospital. They just see me every quarter, say hi to me. That's a big pleasure for us to see them happy and doing what they like to do in their lives and seeing less of us.
Seeing less of you. Dr. Vijay, it's a good way to end. I want to thank you, all three of you, for being with us today. Dr. Vijay is cardiologist at FREDET and the Medical College of Wisconsin. Roger and Rochelle Thompson. Roger got his left ventricular assist device in 2023. Rochelle, married to Roger, supported him through his recovery. It was great to be able to talk with them today. And great to have you listening in today. Appreciate it very much. And also appreciate the work of our whole team here. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and stay with us. Lots in store here on WPR News.